From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar. And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Hey, Eric, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Don.
So we've done sort of a view of your articles, your series of articles on the imperialist response to the rise of the BRICS. We've addressed Brazil, India, China somewhat, and South Africa. Now we're going to take a look at Russia.
Yeah, my so far I've actually, for a variety of reasons, the articles that have come out so far have just been Brazil and South Africa. I'm hoping this week to have at least one, maybe two more come out. But, you know, I think that it's good because these things keep changing. And I think that obviously the Panama Papers story having come out has focused the world's attention a little bit on at least a couple of these countries, obviously China and Russia figuring quite prominently, not simply in terms of the information that was in the Panama Papers, but in fact, I think probably equally important was the treatment in the media and what that really tells us. I mean, of course, particularly Western media, and what that really tells us about exactly what we've been talking about here for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah,
the
you know focus- what else too? This thing about another thing that came out before we go into that with Varoufakis saying that early on, when he was finance minister of Greece, right after Syriza took power, that China had agreed to make some sort of a credit line arrangement for the Greek government, which was blown out of the water by Germany.
Well, it's quite interesting because, of course, that was what I think you and I and a number of other people had been talking about was precisely the direction we wanted to see those things go because, of course, Greece at the time was basically, at least to some degree, in charge of its own fate when it was when it still had the potential for a Grexit on the table, when them leaving the European Union was still a very real possibility, when people still believed that I think Syriza was serious about entertaining that. And I know Varoufakis was, as he said repeatedly in public statements. And obviously, the actual mechanisms by which they would be able to have affected something like that would have required exactly what Varoufakis is talking about, the kind of line of credit, the sort of access to capital to be able to actually, you know, address the most important aspects of their budget without being able to rely on yet another extension of credit from the Troika, from the IMF. So it is interesting that he says that, and obviously I think it's quite revealing why Varoufakis decided to leave Syriza and leave the government, because he was obviously, and this is now pretty much universally acknowledged, at odds with a number of the key decision makers in the Syriza government, including Tsipras, who was much less inclined towards taking an independent direction than was Varoufakis. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's important.
Well, it also shows something about the approach of China. For example, the deal that they were talking about, the Chinese had sent a very strong message that they were willing to do investment, and we know that they do this win-win investment, so it wouldn't have been necessarily, certainly it wouldn't have been as parasitic as the investment that the Europeans, other Europeans have done there, and it would have been a mechanism for them to support if they had to withdraw from the euro. They would have at least had a currency to work with.
Yes, although there are, I think, social and cultural factors that would have made that more difficult. Right. You know, I've spoken to a number of people who are in Greece even today and say that, look, I mean, regardless of whatever potential benefits might have been achieved or might have been gotten from a, you know, a Sino-Greek relationship of that magnitude.
We're in Europe. Yeah,
the people of Greece still see themselves as European. Yeah. They still see their social and cultural desire is to remain within Europe. And whether you want to see that in a negative light from a sort of a colonized mind perspective, or whether you want to see that positively as Greece being the, you know, the heart, the origin of what we call Western culture and Western civilization, you know, whatever. It doesn't really matter how you want to look at it. That's how the Greek people see it, and I think that that's important. But that's not to say that the China option wasn't on the table. And I think for the purposes of what you and I discuss here weekly, the geopolitical context of all of that is actually quite significant, because of course China wanted access to Greece not only as a form of profit generating, you know, money making. Obviously they wanted that. But what they really wanted was they wanted some access and or control of important commercial shipping architecture, commercial shipping infrastructure, I should say. Mm-hmm. Specifically, obviously, the port of Piraeus, the deal that was on the table for the not ownership, but management of that port under Chinese auspices, that being really kind of a foothold into the European economic space, wherein Chinese goods could run through a Chinese-managed port into Europe, thereby really, I think, bringing the entire supply chain under Chinese control, rather than China having to be under the control of various European forces. And obviously that north-south corridor from Greece through the Balkans and into Eastern Europe is obviously very significant. And I think that's really where you see, if you look at the map, that's where you see one of the major confluences between China and Russia, where, you know, China and Russia could actually cooperate in terms of China bringing in consumer goods and commercial investment, creating these what they call investment corridors, while Russia would have, at least at that time, been able to supply the energy that would be necessary in order to affect all of these policies. And so there would have been sort of this overlap of interests there. And of course, on the other side, the United States and the West wanting to break, to cut off the potential for that north-south sort of development, running with a sort of west-east line of strategy that includes, you know, NATO in Bulgaria, NATO in Romania, NATO in Albania, all of these countries basically as a line of defense to cut off this Sino-Russian partnership running north into Europe. So, you know, there's an obvious geostrategic imperative here for both sides. And I think that Greece really found itself as kind of the nexus of all of these forces.
Yeah, we were talking about that back then, because you also, of course, have to consider the military implications of a Chinese-controlled
port. Oh, yeah,
port
absolutely.
Yeah. And we're talking in terms of, how the Panama Papers bear on all of this. But with what we were just talking about with Greece, China is still there. Russia is still there. And this is playing in the background the entire time. There's nothing preventing China and Greece from reaching an agreement today, for example, or next week. And that's in the back of the minds of the imperial structure. And that is the existential threat, the existent threat of the BRICS in general.
Yes, although I think that the current current government and the way that it's constituted, and the sort of, rather than a kind of social democrat alignment with a more far left political formation, that has now passed, and what we now see is more like a center left, center right alliance in the government. And I think that that's probably far less conducive to the kind of partnership that we're talking about here. I mean, they'll obviously allow China to partner with them in various capacities for the, you know, because it generates money, and obviously because China is important to all countries that are operating in the global system. But the potential for China and the BRICS broadly as presenting a real economic alternative in the medium and long term, I think that's probably off the table now. Greece is still in a very bad situation. The government has really kind of, you know, I don't want to get into a debate about it, but to a large extent capitulated to a lot of the demands that the Germans and the Troika have made on them. So I think that from a bargaining perspective, their position is a lot weaker than it was a year ago.
Yeah, that may all well be true. My point is the existence of China and Russia and the BRICS persists, and as the needs of some of the creditors, you know, for an increased return and for exacting more austerity out of Greece continues to present itself. And
yeah, China is the specter haunting Europe.
That's right, exactly right, because, you know, as that produces a response in the Greek population, as they, you know, extract more value from people who are already under siege, those people themselves see China and Russia existing. And the government itself may find itself under pressure, and in any event, at least can go back to the negotiating table and say, China, Russia.
Yeah, although I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, but I do wonder whether the government would be able, the current government would be able to survive, you know, a real outpouring of indignation from the people. I fear that not only would Syriza not be able to survive it, but an even more destructive element could emerge. I mean, I believe, and you know, if you know differently, Don, correct me if I'm wrong, but Golden Dawn is still the third leading party in Greece. I believe in the last elections they pulled number 3. And in a continued economic breakdown, Golden Dawn will be strengthened. Golden Dawn is a very dangerous Nazi element inside of Greece. And I don't think that that bodes well for any of these non-Western forces. I mean, while Syriza has not been the most conducive towards really breaking decisively with European finance capital, they're also in many ways holding at bay some even more deeply reactionary, deeply destructive forces. And I do wonder what direction Greece might go given the continued economic collapse gets deeper, worse, and more painful.
Okay, so let's turn to Russia and to some extent China. We didn't really finish that up, and using just that example and then projecting that globally, of course, we see that the position or the existence of the two of them, the most powerful or one of the most powerful economies on the one hand, and a world-class nuclear power umbrella on the other, present a challenge, to put it mildly, to imperialism.
Yes, indeed. Although kind of the thrust of my articles and what I've been trying to sort of lay out here is that it is because of that, it is because the threat they present to the established order, call it the unipolar versus multipolar versus, you know, monocentric versus polycentric, whatever you want to call it. The reality is that the reason they're under attack is because they present that sort of an alternative. And I think that in the context of Russia, you know, last week we were talking about China and a lot of the issues surrounding that, political undermining of Xi Jinping, you know, propaganda to that end, a lot of the maneuvering in the South China Sea, the maneuvering around ASEAN, and all of these forces have really been, you know, and I don't even know if we mentioned it last week, but of course the Trans-Pacific Partnership as an economic and really simultaneously political framework for potentially trying to isolate as much as it's possible China, particularly set against the backdrop of China's One Belt, One Road economic development model. So all of those machinations, I think, really need to be understood broadly as part of this thrust against the BRICS. And then from the Russian perspective, we see on a number of fronts, Russia really finding itself in the crosshairs. And I think that, you know, I mentioned at the top of the conversation here, the Panama Papers, I think, is an indication of that. Although I'm maybe less less inclined to think of these as particularly significant than some other people are. Not to say that they're not important, but I don't think that they really inflict any significant damage as it pertains to Russia or even necessarily to China. What I do think is important, though, is a number of key developments that have really, I think, come to the fore in the last few weeks. The first is, and we talked a little bit about this, Don, the refusal by Russia to participate in the nuclear summit. Yeah. That was Obama's initiative. Now, why is that important? Well, I think that there's a couple of reasons. Number one is because Russia doesn't believe that the nuclear summit is a nuclear summit. I think that Russia believes that the nuclear summit is really just the pretext, the public relations branding of a summit designed to let's say corral the participants back under the auspices of U.S. foreign policy. Right. If we think back to 2014, the 2014 nuclear summit, I think it was in The Hague, if I remember correctly. And that summit, what did they talk about? Did they talk about nuclear disarmament? No. Did they talk about nuclear doctrines? No. They talked about Russian aggression in Ukraine. Yeah. They talked about Russia as being an existential threat in Eastern Europe. And I think that really left Russia and obviously particularly Putin with a sort of a sour taste in his mouth about the very concept of the nuclear summit. And so Russia's non-participation there, I think, is yet another clear message that, look, Russia's willing to talk. Russia's particularly willing to talk nuclear issues, but Russia's not willing to do it within the framework of what they perceive to be a Russia-bashing forum. And I think that is an obvious failure of the United States, of the Obama administration, because quite frankly, as Obama nears the end of his second term and is on his way out of office, one of the great achievements that he would be able to hang his hat on would be to show that U.S.-Russia relations had sunk to a new low, and that he was willing to do what needed to be done in order to sort of reestablish and to firm up those relations and to rebuild the U.S.-Russia relationship. And he hasn't done that. And I think that rather than a great accomplishment of the Obama administration, it will forever be seen as one of the great disappointments. Not only that all of this happened under Obama's watch, because a lot of that was really out of his control, what I think will be remembered is that he did nothing to rebuild those relations. And if anything, he made them worse. And I think that is something that really needs to be focused on, because it informs a lot of the other developments that we have seen, whether it is pertains to sanctions, the economic situation, which I think is actually much worse than a lot of people are saying it is, whether that pertains to any number of the issues surrounding U.S.-Russia, Obama, I think, really needs to be seen, unfortunately, frankly, as an abject failure.
Not only that, for some context for people on this this particular construct of the so-called nuclear summit. Last week was the seventh anniversary of the speech that President Obama made in his third month as president. It was April 4th, April 5th, 2009, in Prague. That, by the way, was cited as one of the basis for awarding him a Nobel Peace Prize, where he called for nuclear disarmament. And it looked as if he was talking about achieving nuclear disarmament. In the intervening period, we find ourselves now at a point where Obama is investing $1.1 trillion in Yep. nuclear weapons, the largest single weapons project in the history of humanity, as a matter of fact. And the Russian objections that were stated in 2014 and cited again as the media was covering this summit essentially were, the mechanisms for achieving this exist. You have the IAEA, which is tasked with helping to bring this about. You have the various summit agreements between the United States and the USSR, Russia succeeds to, that point towards that and put limits on it. The United States has violated those and now is looking, in the view of Russia, to completely remove itself from that process into this new structure that leads where you just described.
That's right. And I think that it's really kind of pathetic that we think about it now, you know, as you think about it now, that Obama really did get that Nobel Prize, not for what he had done, but for a lot of the things that he promised to do, whether it was ending the war in Iraq or nuclear disarmament and all of these things that really he's proven himself to be exactly what I knew he would be back in 2008, a liar on all of those fronts, little more than a liberal imperialist. And that is exactly what he has shown himself to be. But I want to focus on something else here, because as you were alluding to it, not only does the framework already exist for, you know, these sorts of talks through the IAEA and other mechanisms, but actually Russia has been in the process of modernizing its military, I think has been hoping to be able to invest less in the nuclear deterrent and more in other forms of military investment. And so there was an economic factor, I think, that would have really been quite appealing to Moscow if they were able to move in that direction. But obviously, Russia's not going to make any moves to limit or to reduce its nuclear stockpile as it sees the United States doing precisely the opposite. So in many ways, this is the United States instigating what can only be described as not only not a nuclear disarmament, but really a nuclear buildup. And that is one of the really sad aspects of all of this, especially considering all of the dangers that we know with regard to nuclear, not only nuclear weapons, but nuclear power in the wake of Fukushima. As we see nuclear energy policies being expanded around the world, which in my view is an incredibly dangerous and very stupid development for all countries involved. All of these things, I think, could have been mitigated to some degree had Obama and the United States been willing to do so. But of course, they haven't been. In fact, if anything, the Obama administration, or maybe we should say the ruling class, while Obama has been the inhabitant of the White House, has been actually much more interested in warmongering against Russia and in doing whatever it can to destabilize. And that's really where I want to focus the conversation, if I could, on the various aspects of destabilization against Russia and how that is manifesting itself in, you know, in the real world. For instance, just as one example, there are a lot of people in Russia, a lot of experts in Russia, a lot of people who have sway in foreign policy circles and in national security circles, who believe, I think with some justification, that the United States intends to try to implement some sort of a Maidan scenario in Russia. We've seen talk about this going back to late 2013 and early 2014. The whole Maidan, you know, the Maidan movement in Ukraine, a lot of people in Russia really saw that as a precursor, a sort of a test case for how they might be able to implement something like that in Russia. And that's why you've seen countermeasures taken over the course of the last couple of years, including the strengthening of laws against foreign NGOs or foreign financing for NGOs and transparency about that and the registration as foreign agents and all of the rest of that. We have seen a lot of that really geared towards, I think, heading off any potential for a political destabilization, a color revolution, or something along those lines. And the reason I bring that up is because I think that that is really the backdrop for understanding the announcement by Russia of the formation of a National Guard. The National Guard announcement was a surprise to a lot of people. When was that? This past week, or was it the week before? I forget. But in any event, it was just in recent days. And there's been a lot of chatter about this, about what is the reason behind that. Now, I think that there could be a couple of reasons, and they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. As I mentioned, I think that this is first and foremost an attempt to base basically bring under the president the authority to be able to head off potential civil unrest. Okay, now there's two kinds of civil unrest that I think that they're concerned about. On the one hand, a Western-sponsored, Western-manufactured color revolution Maidan scenario, which is still very much a possibility, despite, you know, statements to the contrary. I do think that there are forces in the West who would very much like to see that and would very much like to try it, even if they think it won't be successful. So it's an attempt to kind of be able to control the streets without having to rely on the military and without having to rely on, you know, the traditional police structures, because they may or may not be either A, equipped to handle it, B, let's say, loyal or as loyal to the president and to the current government as maybe they would like them to be. Or, you know, there's a whole bunch of reasons we could point to for why they would think that way. But I think that there is a very real belief that they need to have a National Guard force under the auspices of the president without the intermediary of a government minister. And that's what the National Guard will be. The authority, the head of the National Guard as designated by Putin, is one of Putin's closest allies, close associate, going back to the days under the mayor of St. Petersburg. And so I think that there is obviously a loyalty factor here, which again points to this question of what kind of unrest, what kind of instability might they be expecting, up to and including potentially not being able to count on the loyalty of some key ministers. I think that that's a very real question. Now, secondarily, and this is one that is, you know, certainly controversial among Russian people and particularly Russian media, that has to do with the question of economic unrest. Because, you know, the media in the West would present the situation as a doomsday scenario in Russia. The sky is falling, the economy is collapsing any day now, right? Paul Krugman has written God knows how many columns to that effect, and obviously it has come to naught at this point. However, the Russian media presents it as this: there's no real significant economic issues, which if you talk to ordinary Russian people, as I have quite recently, that is also not the case. There is very real economic hurt. The sanctions have been hurting. They haven't crippled, but they have been hurting. The inflation issue is a very significant one. People's wages are not going as far as they did even a year or two ago. People are not buying as much. This is having a significant impact on the domestic Russian economy. Now, the reason I bring this up is not to say that what is happening currently is going to lead to the fall of the government. What I am suggesting, though, is that it points to a potential for unrest given an economy that deteriorates significantly further. If that were to happen, you could see very real unrest, not just in Moscow, but really in other parts of the country, parts of the country that are dependent upon exports, in particular agricultural exports or industrial exports or what have you. So if we see the economic situation in Russia deteriorate, the potential for unrest is there. Now, how does a government quell that kind of unrest? Do you bring in the military? Well, I don't think that's a good idea. I think that would be exactly what the West would want. Do you bring out the police? Well, not necessarily a good idea either, because the police might not be equipped to handle something like that. And so they find this kind of a third way, quote unquote, in the establishment of a National Guard. Now, I'm not going to suggest that it's a, you know, it's a good or a bad thing. I'm simply trying to explain what I see as the rationale behind this move.
And you know, by the way, remind people that the Department of Homeland Security was created in the United States about 14 years ago. And there wasn't the kind of global critique of it that the United States and its allies have offered about the creation of the National Guard in Russia. You know,
obviously not. I mean, it goes without saying.
On this point, I mean, it's clear that the whatever pain the Russian economy is suffering as a consequence of the sanctions was intended. And in fact, if you had listened to the pronouncements, as I know you did, and many of us did, coming out of Washington at the time, they had hoped for much greater pain to be inflicted on the economy. Yeah. And that is coupled with this political activity. We saw most recently the manifestation of it last week with the release of the Panama Papers, where they attempted to essentially use this example of the structural corruption of the neoliberal global empire as evidence that Putin is somehow a crook. And and what was striking to me, and we've seen this displayed repeatedly, is basically the ham-handedness of these people, as if they're so far out of touch and they believe their own propaganda so thoroughly that they are not able to understand how these things are going to play out. Because in my opinion, from looking around, it seems to me that people are looking at the Panama Papers as evidence of the corruption of the Western system and not so worried about Putin, regardless of what the talking heads are saying on television.
Well, that's right. That's kind of the backfire here, the blowback, you know, as it's almost unimaginable that they couldn't see that coming, but maybe not. I don't really know. Just one point on the Russian economy question. I'm not suggesting, because I don't think it's accurate to say that Russia's economy is in a significant decline because of the sanctions. I think the sanctions are hurting. I think the sanctions have had an impact, but really it's the collapse of oil prices. It's the attempt by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and some of the other elements that the U.S. is able to influence to really tank global oil prices, which has caused a significant decrease in revenues. And obviously that means everything from, you know, the Russian central bank having to do some, you know, political and financial gymnastics to the need to shuffle around the budget, to cut things out of the budget and things like that. That is, I think, really the elephant in the room that unfortunately is almost never discussed when talking about the Russian economic situation. That, I think, is really the driving force. The sanctions are more peripheral, but I bring it up only to say in relation to this National Guard issue, that I do think that that is one of a number of factors that is driving this move. And I think it needs to be understood that way, because really this is part of a broader strategy that Russia is employing to defend itself from what it perceives, I think correctly, as attempts by the United States to undermine the very institutions of the Russian state, the political institutions, the financial, economic institutions, and the social institutions. We've seen a number of examples of this, and obviously, you know, we remember the so-called white revolution, the white protests in 2012 in Moscow, which failed, which petered out. But I think it showed perhaps not only the model that they might use, but the sort of the how should I put it, the fertile ground that they were trying to create for a larger, perhaps more widespread protest movement. And I think that the economic situation is really kind of the window for them to be able to do that. And that's what Russia is responding to.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, the oil crisis or the producers crisis in oil markets is something that was another weaponized economic tool, basically.
Absolutely.
That was targeting
and also,
them. It's interesting also because, again, it's almost ham-handed, because now we're looking at the repercussions in Saudi Arabia and other places. There's very possibly some very serious political considerations that have to be looked at in Saudi Arabia. But for me, the interesting thing about all of this is if you look at the BRICS as a, you know, as an entity, which, you know, it barely is, there's almost like a federal nature to it in terms of the economics, in terms of how that has played out. Because as they sanctioned Russia and as they started tanking oil prices, China turns around as a major consumer of petroleum and natural gas and such, turns around and makes a long-term deal with Russia, taking advantage of that and supporting Russia at the same time, both against the sanctions and against the falling oil prices.
Yeah, although China is facing its own economic issues. I wouldn't call it a crisis necessarily. I think that's overblown by the Western media for many reasons. But China is facing very real economic issues and an economic downturn. Now, for China, a downturn is a downturn away from record growth to, you know, decreased growth, still being growth, of course. But that I think that that is significant as well. China's demand for energy is going to be less than what a lot of people thought it was going to be 3 to 5 years ago. You know, the Chinese government itself, you know, through the official channels, I think Xinhua and a couple of the other state media outlets reported the Chinese government talking about the bracing for the impact of millions of jobs being cut and many thousands of factories being closed in some key industries. And this, of course, relates to Chinese economic planning. They planned for X, and the situation is now Y. Therefore, they have to adjust accordingly. So, I mean, we get all of that. It's not an indication that China is on the verge of collapse the way that the Economist seemingly every year has their annual China on the verge of collapse issue. But I do think that it is an indication that, again, where China signed a deal with Russia for all of this energy, how much of the energy that China thought it was going to need does it actually need? And where does that leave Russia? Again, another, I think, lever by which the United States and its allies are trying to chip away at this not really necessarily chipping away at the BRICS, you know, in and of itself, but chipping away at these various multipolar structures that have been emerging. And think about it from a foreign policy perspective. One of the ways that the Russians and the Chinese, for that matter, are able to exert their influence is by being able to bring economic and from China's perspective, economic, from Russia's perspective, military and energy deals to other countries around the world. Now, Russia's capacity and China's capacity to help, say, for instance, in Latin America, Venezuela is a good example. Argentina is a good example. Ecuador is a good example. These countries, which have been making strides over the last decade, decade and a half, to moving towards these non-Western actors, they are now hurting as well as a result of this. Venezuela, for obvious reasons, because oil accounts for the vast majority of the budget. Venezuela is in a very, very deep economic crisis for many reasons, including economic destabilization and subversion, including the collapse of global oil prices. All of that is the causes of Venezuela's suffering. But in order to be able to bring itself out of that, it needs to expand its relations, economic, political, and otherwise, with Russia and with China. And the decreased capacity of Russia and China to offer these type of deals because of this economic crisis also hurts Venezuela, which in turn hurts the rest of Latin America, as Venezuela has been a leading, you know, the leading edge of the Latin American integration processes and Latin America's strategic pivot towards China. So you see that there is a global geopolitical implication to this destabilization and subversion of Russia and China. That's really kind of the what should I call it, the macro view, the aerial view of these moves by the U.S.
And then, of course, you have all of the political considerations, too. You mentioned Venezuela, and there's a political fallout from the economic warfare that's conducted against Venezuela by the United States, which we see in the last election for the National Assembly. We also see that in Brazil, because for the same reason, the falling energy prices have made it more difficult for the government to continue to uplift people there. And that with a pronounced political attack on the right and allegations of corruption against Petrobras by the you know, media there, people are willing to buy it at a gut level because they see less good being done by it.
Well, and also the Panama Papers, I believe, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the Panama Papers said something about Lula using an offshore account to purchase a house somewhere. So again, you see yet another example of how the Panama Papers are really
weaponized.
Providing the fodder for stoking some of these fires that are already ongoing, right? So the undermining of Brazil is part of this larger strategy as well. Don't forget, and just going back a couple of episodes here, don't forget that the movement in Brazil is being led by organizations that are directly connected to and funded by the Koch brothers, okay? This is Western capital. This is Wall Street really seeking to undermine a government in Brazil, which has been more or less inclined to pursue an independent policy. Now, while, you know, Brazil is not, you know, anti-capitalist exactly, I mean, they're very much actors in the global economy. Brazil has been, let's call it, social democratic orientation with a focus on poverty reduction and all of these other things, and with expanding relations with Russia, China, India, the BRICS generally. So, you know, we see this sort of multi-pronged effort to undermine all of these different countries and all these different key corners of the world. And that is, I think, where the Panama Papers fit in. The problem I really have with the Western media, the way that it's handled this Panama Papers story, is not that they're covering it. I think it is an important story and I think it deserves coverage. And if, you know, if associates of Putin or associates of Xi Jinping or Lula or whomever is, you know, named in there, whatever, then that's a news story and it should be covered. The problem I have is in seeing the story in isolation, seeing it as a single news story that branches out into all these different places. Rather, the way that I think it should be seen is part of a much larger news story, which is the attempt by the United States to reassert hegemony globally and try to pry away whatever influence has been coalesced around BRICS, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Eurasian Economic Union, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, One Belt, One Road, all of these initiatives that are really non-Western initiatives. That is what they're trying to undermine. Panama Papers, one piece of that broader strategy.
Yeah, for sure. And just to refresh people's memories about Brazil. The large oil find in the pre-salt layer in Brazil that Lula announced essentially was going to go to the publicly owned oil corporation and not to ExxonMobil and other Western oil companies, that is percolating underneath a lot of the moves against the government in Brazil.
Absolutely. Just as you're exactly right, just as it is in Venezuela, because remember that President Maduro in Venezuela was challenging the notion that Guyana had sovereignty over the offshore oil finds, north of the Venezuela, Guyana, French Guyana, Brazil corridor, right? The that is considered to be one of the largest untapped oil fields in the world. And Venezuela was demanding that they have their sovereign rights be respected. Now, in the United States in particular, and in the West and among the right wing in Venezuela, even, they'll say Venezuela has no sovereignty over this. This is Guyana's territory. But of course, they don't like to bring up the fact that ExxonMobil funded the current government in Guyana, funded its rise to power, that ExxonMobil is really using Guyana as a front for their own interests, and broadly speaking, of U.S. and Western oil interests against Venezuela. So you see, in Brazil, any attempt to assert independence and sovereignty against Western oil is challenged with a variety of tools of political destabilization. The same has happened in Venezuela. And of course, if you ask Russia, if you ask China, if you ask any of these countries, they'll tell you that that's exactly what's happening.
And now, looking at Russia and China, there is the geopolitical / military aspect to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the other stories of this week that really deserves attention is the escalation of the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh, the frozen conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, which is really much more a much larger conflict. Let me rephrase that. It's not that the conflict is larger. The geopolitical significance of it is much greater than the skirmishes that we have seen over the last 20 years. Now, I just want to point out a couple of different aspects to this. The commencement of the maybe a little bit of background, I guess. This was a conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia that emerges at the end of the Soviet Union. A peace deal is agreed to under the auspices of Russia in 1994, which basically leaves this as a frozen conflict. Armenia basically took control of a, for relatively speaking, significant percent of territory that had been Azerbaijani, and that's this Nagorno-Karabakh region. Now, it should be remembered, though, Russia is a strategic ally of Armenia. Russia has military forces based in Armenia. Russia is, in effect, the guarantor of Armenian security. On the other side, Azerbaijan, since the end of the Soviet Union, has really attempted to present itself as an ally of the United States, in particular, an ally of the West. I mean, just look at the travel documents from George Friedman in Stratfor over the last 15 years, and you could see how many times they have gone over to Azerbaijan. The attempt to foster these relations has, of course, the geopolitical significance being that Azerbaijan was supposed to be the foothold for the United States in the Caspian. Azerbaijan was going to be this huge oil producer. They were going to provide energy via Trans-Caspian, either the Trans-Caspian pipeline itself or various other projects, including Nabucco, including some other pipelines that were supposed to transport these massive amounts of oil out of Azerbaijan, out of the Caspian, and directly towards the European economic space via these pipeline projects. And in fact, what's come out in the last couple of years is that Azerbaijan significantly oversold itself. It oversold, overstated, overestimated its capacity. It cannot provide even close to the amount of energy that it said it was going to be able to. And so for that reason, a lot of those pipeline projects have kind of fallen by the wayside. Those companies, BP and Royal Dutch Shell and ExxonMobil and all of these others that wanted to get in on investing in these pipelines, they have either decided not to or they've significantly reduced the amount they're willing to invest. And obviously, with the collapse of oil prices, that has only escalated. Now, I think that the reason I want to bring that up is where Azerbaijan fits in the regional landscape and in the global landscape. The United States is, I think, less interested in Azerbaijan today than they were 15 years ago. But the factor, or the actor, I should say, that is more interested now than ever is Turkey. Turkey, because they need a lever against Russia, I think is one of the driving elements behind the re-escalation or the reigniting of this conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. And we should understand, too, the neo-Ottoman outlook of Erdogan and Davutoglu, this view sees Azerbaijan and all of these countries as part of the Turkish sphere of influence. They really see their sphere of influence stretching from Turkey in the west damn near to Xinjiang and Western China, all the way in the east with the Uyghur people. All of these Turkic, linguistic family nations, the Erdogan government sees as part of their sphere of influence, and they want to use Azerbaijan as a lever against Russia, obviously to sweeten the deal in Syria. Erdogan wants to be able to turn the screws in Syria and turn the screws against the Kurds, and it seems that he's using the Azerbaijan conflict in order to do that. Now, obviously, it hasn't escalated much further than I think a lot of us anticipated, and Russia and the U.S. seemingly, at least from their language, are on the same page as far as conflict resolution. Where does that leave Turkey? Where does that leave Turkey-Russia relations, and what is the connection to Syria? I think all of that needs to be seen as part of this conflict.
And there's a historical context with Turkey and Armenia too, isn't there?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that. You're right. I shouldn't say that goes without saying. It should be noted, obviously, the Armenian genocide that the Turkish Ottomans perpetrated 100 years ago, that still looms very large. That's still a huge issue for the Armenians and the, and let's not forget, the Armenian lobby is actually really strong in the United States, and Armenians and the Armenia lobby is also quite strong in Russia. And so I think that, again, there is this sort of tit for tat situation going on here. And it's also, again, the Eurasian Economic Union, the desire of Russia to reassert some level of economic influence in the former Soviet space, all of that, I think, is part of this conflict.
Yeah, Lukoil is pretty active in Azerbaijan as well. I mean, ExxonMobil, Amoco, you know, all of those companies. But there was a deal signed a few years after the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1994 that established an oil consortium, and both sides were represented in that.
Yeah, exactly. But we, I think, should point out, though, that the reason that the Azerbaijani dictator slash president Aliyev, why he made so many trips to the United States, and why he was invited to speak at the Center for Strategic International Studies, why he was his son was invited to speak at Harvard and all of the rest of these places, you know, the Kennedy School of Government, all of these very elite institutions in the West, is because they saw Azerbaijan as the future of Western political and economic influence into the former Soviet space. And I think that a lot of them have been significantly disappointed by what Azerbaijan has actually been able to deliver. And that is, in many ways, the way that I view this, at least, is that Turkey is now rushing in to fill the void that has been left by the non-assertiveness of the United States here. Now, for that reason, I think Azerbaijan and Armenia both, in fact, have attempted to try to pursue, I guess, what could be called a sort of multi-vector foreign policy, right? So a foreign policy that is in many ways geared towards both the West and towards Russia. Because when we saw this outcry about human rights in Azerbaijan over the last 2 years, forget what the event was. There was a major sporting event that was held in Azerbaijan. It was like the European Games or something like that, as if Azerbaijan is in Europe. But anyway, the European Games or something to that effect. And a bunch of countries had threatened to boycott because of the human rights situation in Azerbaijan. Now, I think you and I both know that human rights is one of the tools that is a political tool for the purposes of propaganda when it is necessary. So why was Human Rights Watch and Transparency International and all of these Western-funded NGOs, why were they hammering Azerbaijan about human rights when, of course, they don't hammer a lot of the other human rights violators? I think it was because it was at that moment, a couple of years ago, that they had really decided that Azerbaijan was not going to be considered part of the Western strategic orbit. And at that moment, Azerbaijan turned towards Russia a little bit, wanting to export, in particular for the purposes of import substitution in Russia. As the sanctions have increased, Azerbaijan has looked to, you know, exporting, I think it's like fruit and, you know, some other agricultural goods and some other things, obviously not energy, to Russia. So there's a complicated series of relations here that I think form the backdrop of the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, and in many ways overshadow it.
And we saw evidence of that, I think it was Thursday or Friday, there was a press conference that had Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, Azerbaijani Foreign Minister Mamedyarov, and Mohammad Zarif from Iran, and Armenia's Foreign Minister in Azerbaijan. I think it was Friday.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, Azerbaijan and the Azeri ethnic group is very represented in Iran. Obviously, those relations go back many, many centuries as far as ethnically. And of course, politically, they're well represented in the Iranian government, that ethnic group. Actually, I should note before we end here, Iran fits into this question as well, because as the U.S. tries to isolate Russia, this has now finally allowed Russia to agree to deliver the S-300 missile system sanctions to Iran. I think a major, major development, because as the nuclear agreement becomes, the sort of the rules of the game, Iran is now opened up to getting those S-300s, or maybe we should say Russia is now opened up to delivering the S-300s. Now, it's somewhat outdated technology in comparison to Russia's S-400s, which they've supplied to China and which they're now deploying all throughout Russia and actually elsewhere. But the S-300s nonetheless make any attack on Iran much more difficult. That obviously puts a damper on John Bolton and the neocon strategy, which that loudmouth was talking about on Fox News just this week. We had to bomb Iran. The time to bomb Iran has passed, and now we need to think about what other ways we can wage war against Iran. All of this sort of stuff, that's going to become very difficult. The question as far as Iran goes is, are they going to move closer to Russia? Are they going to move closer to China? We saw this One Belt, One Road train arriving in Iran a couple of weeks ago as sort of the first of what is likely to be hundreds of thousands, millions of train arrivals, over the course of the next few decades. So I think that a new geopolitical architecture is emerging in the Asian space that the United States is very concerned about, the West is very concerned about. And again, yet another reason they want to undermine both Russia and China. They want to prevent any integration of these other non-Western countries, in particular a country like Iran. And one of the fertile grounds in which we could see this cooperation between these countries is in the post-occupation Afghanistan. That's why the United States is really fearful of leaving Afghanistan, because they know if they do, into the void comes China and comes Iran, two major players in Afghanistan economically and two players that have a significant amount of political influence. If you think the United States is willing to have waged a 15-year war in Afghanistan only to leave it to China and Iran, you're crazy.
And on that note, we've been speaking with Eric Dreitzer, a website, stopimperialism.org, about the last in the series of articles on the Western response to the rise of BRICS and multipolarity generally. Where can people find that?
The articles have appeared on Mint Press News. I've fallen a little bit behind this week with a lot of other work, but soon to be the third, fourth, and fifth installments on mintpressnews.com.
And next week,
and we'll come and back. Please do catch my show Counterpunch Radio in partnership with Counterpunch. You can find it on iTunes and on counterpunch.org.
And next week, maybe we'll do a wrap up of the entire series.
Sounds good.
Eric, thanks a lot. Pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.